Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's Mel Herbert here for the C3 Project. I've been delinquent, you might say culpable, you might say sort of derelict, perhaps even inattentive, indifferent, indolent. You might say lazy, even neglectful, perhaps negligent, sloppy, even slothful, slow, at least tardy even, unmindful and wool gathering. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I can read a thesaurus. The C3 Project is now almost a year old, and what we should have been doing, what I should have been doing, is doing some follow-up letters, notes, rants, explanations as we go. And so we're going to start that this month. We're going to do a little bit of catch-up, but then every month, about mid-month, we're going to have a little bit of discussion about some of the more controversial aspects of the C3 from the month before. So let us first talk about vag bleeding, both first trimester and non-pregnant vag bleeding. And the first letter we have is from Nick J, and he says this. Early in the podcast, you stated that if a woman is going to miscarry, it is likely inevitable and there is nothing they can do to stop it. And this is my understanding. Later, when talking about subchorionic hemorrhage, you said you would recommend that the woman go on pelvic. The statement seems at odds. Pelvic rest does not make sense to me. And I can't imagine the trauma from standing, walking, or intercourse is local enough to truly increase a woman's chance of miscarriage. Also, I never found actual data supporting pelvic rest as a way to decrease the chance of miscarriage. Do you know of any data that supports this? I haven't come across it. Or is this just based on expert opinion? Nick J, you are indeed correct. It is almost impossible to find any evidence for this practice. In fact, let's go back a step further. We used to say to women with bleeding in the first trimester that they should go on bed rest. Not just pelvic rest, but pelvic rest and bed rest. And the evidence we have for bed rest now, and there's not a lot of articles, but it suggests that actually it doesn't work at all, or maybe possibly even makes miscarriage more frequent. And so I can find no randomized trials of pelvic rest, which is no intercourse, no orgasms, because that can contract the uterus theoretically and that'll be bad, no tampons, no douching. That sort of pelvic rest, I can't find any evidence for that in a randomized trial. Having said that, however, C3 we're presenting here is sort of the standard defensible approach to many of these conditions. If you want the cutting edge, you go to the MRAP main show. In fact, Rob O has an interview coming up, which really questions everything we talked about in those first trimester and vag bleed C3 episodes, suggesting that maybe you don't even need Rogam. Maybe you don't even need to test for UTI. Maybe you don't need to do a pelvic exam. So it's pretty radical. Now, you should listen to that. It's coming up in coming months. But again, C3 is here's what's standard, here's what's in textbooks, here's what's reasonably defensible in terms of everyday practice. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it is correct, because we know that most of what we do in medicine is not evidence-based, because there's no evidence. And so it is expert-based, or it's tradition-based. So you bring up a good point. Bed rest, probably no evidence at all, and maybe worse. Pelvic rest, we don't know. It is standard practice to talk about pelvic rest, but until we have a randomized trial, I don't know if we should or shouldn't do it. And this will keep coming up over and over again on C3. Again, C3 is supposed to be approaches to things to get people who are new in emergency medicine sort of up to speed. What's everybody kind of doing right now? Then if you want the cutting edge, you go to the main show of MRAP, and that'll give you some cutting edge and where we might be headed with this stuff. But you've got to be really careful as a new practitioner, if you are one, to not stray too far away from what everybody else is doing, because you're a new practitioner. You don't necessarily know all the nuance yet. And you certainly are at much greater risk for being, you know, seriously criticized if you don't do it. So if an intern came to me and said, I'm not going to give Rogam, I'm not going to check for a UTI, I'm not going to do a pelvic exam, I'm just going to slap on an ultrasound, which is some of the stuff that you're going to hear on an upcoming MRAP episode, I'd say either this person's a genius or this person is a fool. And I'm going to have to say that they're a fool until they prove to me that they're a genius on the cutting edge. And so for most of the time, don't live on the cutting edge. Early in your career. That's for later in your career. But it is always important, as you're doing things or not doing things, ask yourself the question, what is the evidence basis for this? Yes, it is true. Lots of time we will continue to do stuff, and we do every single day, every single shift. We continue to do stuff for which there is essentially no evidence. But it's kind of the way we've always done it, and we can't really change that until there's evidence. Or until somebody of authority, whatever that means, starts to change it and it turns out that it didn't kill anybody. But you got to be careful about doing that yourself on the front line when you're not that person or institution or department or whatever it is you want to call it of authority. under the same topic, we got a letter, and I can't remember who it's from, so forgive me, which suggested that perhaps we should stop using the term abortion when we're talking about these spontaneous miscarriages, because it really makes people feel weird still, even in 2016, when you call a miscarriage an abortion, and it can get confusing, and there's some religious undertones for a lot of people. So I think that's a really good point. When describing it to the patients, maybe even when we're doing it on an education series, we should perhaps talk about threatened miscarriage, inevitable miscarriage. It takes away some of that emotive language. Language is important, and particularly when you're talking to the patients, it's perhaps better to discuss it in terms of a miscarriage than abortion because of all these social, religious overtones that can come with that term. So I like that. I think that's a pretty good insight. Another clinician asked, and of course again, because I'm just getting my act together, I don't have their name, asked about the use of TXA, transexamic acid, in heavy vag bleeding in both the pregnant and non-pregnant patient. So we're now starting to think about using this in trauma and lots of bleeding disorders. So this sort of helps you keep the clot in there, and so maybe this could be useful. Well, there's actually a fair bit of literature about using this in high-risk patients post-C-section, in post-delivery bleeding, and the evidence that we have suggests that it actually might reduce bleeding a little bit in those circumstances as well. What about in first trimester bleeding? What about in the non-pregnant patient that just comes in with a lot of bleeding? What about in those cases? Well, there is a very small number of papers on this as well, and you'll find them in the show notes. But basically, they are very small. They suggest there's possibly, in patients where you've tried other things, the use of TXA might be useful. But because they're small, we don't really have a good handle on the harm that potentially could occur from this drug, although it appears in the big studies to be a pretty safe drug. So again, it's not necessarily something I would lead with, but I also wouldn't freak out if people in your department are using it. And again, if in your place people are comfortable using this under specific circumstances, it's not outside any sort of standard of care, whatever that means. But if, again, you're asking what is the evidence basis for using TXA in first trimester bleeding or in dysfunctional uterine bleeding, which is very heavy, there is very little evidence. I put a few articles in the show notes. If you're interested, you can read it. But again, these are not big papers. And with these type of drugs, we worry about prothrombotic effects, which may not show up in 10 patients or in 20 patients. You might need thousands of patients to know exactly what's the downside, even though it might reduce bleeding, which is good. What's the downside? You don't really know downsides until you do big studies. And way back months ago in the asthma C3, we had a patient that we presented where we were giving them maximal medical therapy, and this person was on a beta blocker. And a lot of people ask the question, should you reverse the beta blocker and with what? And so I've talked to a number of experts in this area. I've talked to a number of toxicologists, and nobody can agree because, again, there is no study that says asthma, having a bad asthma attack, should I reverse their beta blocker if they're on that for some reason? And so we don't know. Yes, you can reverse beta blockers with glucagon, but you have to use fairly high doses, and that can make people vomit. And many toxicologists now believe that a better way of reversing beta blockers is with high-dose insulin glucose therapy. And so I guess if you've tried everything else and you're doing maximal medical therapy, that in somebody who's on beta blocker for a reason, some reason, then maybe you should do it. But again, the evidence basis for that is unclear, but it's another thing you could add to your armamentarium, particularly in that patient that's sick. You want to try everything. So let's call that done for this month. We're going to be doing these every month. We're going to call these letters corrections and rants. My name's Mel Herbert, and this is the C3 Project.